Okay, well, let's see what's currently at going, okay? There's two of them, and they the exact same spot both times, but I'm sorry, like I say that.
Oh my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please. Are we just, are you ready for this?
Cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular
disc.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me there'd be days like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light, struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
Most peculiar, Mama.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, and welcome to our listeners around the world to edition number 363 of Strange Days Indeed, the program that observes and reports on the phenomena that surround one of the greatest mysteries that humanity has ever faced, UFOs, unidentified flying objects. This program gives you the opportunity to expand your mind and hear from and about credible people who've had incredible experiences. Tonight, Dave Furlott with his take on it, our British correspondent and publisher of UFO Review, Stuart Miller, with his monthly check-in. And in the second hour, we finally get to talk with someone who has researched UFOs in the Bible, Patrick Cook, author of The Greatest Deception, The Bible UFO Connection, will join us here on SDI tonight. Good to have you along. Got an interesting email a couple of 3 weeks ago, just before the UFO symposium, and haven't had a chance to get to the content of that email. Actually, more specifically, the attachment which Gary sent me a couple of weeks back. An interesting report that Gary recorded on a home tape recorder. It's his grandmother telling her story about something that happened to her at Buckhorn Lake. Here's Gary to set it up.
This was reported to you by my grandmother, who was just approaching 95 years of age. Not a person to exaggerate. What she tells you here is what she and five other people witnessed.
This was in November, around 83 or 84. I just can't remember the year. It was our bingo night. 6:30, we linked. My neighbors, next door neighbors, went to the bingos with me, and they came out. I walked out on the deck, waiting for my husband to lock the side door, and thought, what a beautiful night. It was so still, not a sound, dark, peaceful. And my neighbors came out that time. I don't know whether the deck lights were on or not. And I looked towards the lake, and here is, I thought, was a fancy yacht parked 30 feet from the house. It was there, and nobody ever heard it come in. Not one sound. And we'd never had anything big come in the bay before. Just rowboats or motorboats like ours, which are only 14, 15, 16 feet boats, that sort of thing. Because the water isn't that deep. And there was lights across the top of it. That's all I could see at that point, was these lights. And I tried to look through them to see if somebody was looking at me. But you could see a light, but you couldn't see any forms or anything. It's like a glass brick, 4 or 5 inches square. And there was about 10 or 12 of them across the top of this boat. The lights were colored orange, blue, all the way across. the nose of the boat wasn't sharp. It was rounded, sort of. I couldn't see the other side of it, of course. I just saw the side that was up against our wall, where you would just step out the door of the boat onto the lawn. But there was no doors or regular windows or anything, nothing. I looked quickly around the lawn to see if I could see any people that might have got off the boat, maybe visiting neighbors in the area, and there was nobody there. And I knew whoever was in that boat was watching us. All I had to do was walk down the steps from the deck, which we did. We were getting within about 6 feet of it, I swear. I looked up at it, and it was metal, made of metal. There was no windows, no doors, no rails, nothing. So I said, "Carl," and instant I said, "Carl," it took off straight up in the air. All I heard was a very faint hum. There was no other sound. I was stunned. We were all stunned. And when I think back on it, the water wasn't disturbed at all, so it couldn't have been sitting in the water, which is only about 3 feet below the lawn. And all of a sudden, when it circled the bay overhead, there was swish, swish, swish. It seemed like small airplanes in the dark. They were just dark forms. In fact, when these things swished over our heads, the men were tall men. They ducked too. I ducked, you know. It was so close, but the swish, and that's just as fast as I could see it. That's how fast they traveled. Swish, swish, swish. And they went behind the island, which was about 1,000 feet away from our house. And the lights went out. There was no more. Period. We went to the bingo. And the people in the lineup waiting for cards were talking about these planes or whatever it was. And a couple of women had been coming down Curve Lake Road into the village to the bingo. And she said, "Oh, it was just a helicopter. It followed us all the way down Curve Lake Road." I said, "It was no helicopter. You'd hear that it was a helicopter." That was the end of that. Next morning, my neighbor, Gwen, she was going out to see if she could see any signs in the bay, and I followed her out, and there was this big area around, I think, 15, 20 feet, maybe, where all the bulrushes, the tall grasses were down. I phoned the newspaper, and they said they'd had other calls in. They wanted to know if there was a power station near me, and I said I didn't know. Anyway, they thanked me for calling, and that was the last I heard of it. It bothered me for a couple of weeks after that. I was depressed. When I went to Toronto to visit my daughter, I told them about it, and they said there was an address out in the west end of Toronto which you could write to report anything. So I did, and my son, he's a commercial artist, he drew a picture of it as I told him what it looked like and sent it in to these people. And they said they would get back to me. Never heard anything. I was stunned. We were all stunned. I didn't think of UFOs or anything else. To me, it was a boat, and it still is a boat.
That witness just turned 95 years old. That happened back in November of either 82 or 83 up at Buckhorn Lake, which is here in Ontario. Our thanks to Gary for sending us that file, and thanks to Gary's grandmother for putting it on tape. It's one of those amazing stories, one of many hundreds that seem to come from the lakes around this part of Ontario over the years. It's really quite amazing, the number of UFO reports that come from lakes in the Muskokas and in the Kawarthas.
Here with his take on it, is Dave Furlong.
My dad is a venerable senior gentleman visiting with my family right now, and last night he said something to me that got me scouring the files of my previous takes to respond to his comment of, I don't believe there are any aliens or UFOs. To wit, I offer up a previous take that I believe is very important to people who have trouble believing. Something that I referred to many times over the years, and most ufologists like myself have actually ignored, is the United States Air Force Project Blue Book files. And the reason that most of us who are interested in UFOs really have done this is pretty evident. Based on what we believe happened or has been happening around us, believing that the United States Air Force could reasonably investigate UFO sightings and give us an unbiased view would be akin to a shepherd asking a wolf to give him an inventory count of his sheep. Now, to think that the numbers might be skewed just a little would not be outside the realm of believability. But even if we take the skewed numbers with a grain of salt, a slight investigation into Project Blue Book gives us some staggering numbers. In fact, they are so staggering that I challenge anyone with a functioning brain to look me in the eyes and tell me there is no such thing as UFOs. The U.S. Air Force investigated over 12,000 cases, and through their investigations, they encountered 585 cases for which they could not offer a rational explanation, and as such gave the cases the ubiquitous title of unexplained, which in true United States Air Force parlance says everything and nothing. Now, just those 585 cases should give you time to pause and reflect, but if you investigate those sighting reports even deeper, you quickly discover more things that throw you for a loop. For example, just in 1952 alone, there were 210 cases that Project Blue Book stated were unexplained. Now, we also have to remember that back in 1952, we were at war with the Korean War being in progress. However, what might have gone slightly unnoticed during that time was that the Nobel Physics Prize was awarded to Felix Bloch and Edward Purcell for their development of new methods for nuclear magnetic precision measurements and discoveries in connection therewith, which again could be something or nothing, but think about that award for a second and you have to wonder about machinery, or maybe even propulsion engines. But back to the 585 unexplained Blue Book cases for a moment. First, from the exemplary groundwork done by Don Berliner in 1974, we find that of those 585 cases, 13 of them have actually gone missing. Now, really, gentle listener, we should not really put too much into those 13 missing cases. It is possible that the paperwork could have gotten misplaced or lost or accidentally misfiled, even if, as reported on this program, we have information that already states that the investigation of UFOs has a higher classification than the hydrogen bomb. We lost the files. Yeah, that's the ticket. They're lost. But there is even more fun with the Project Blue Book files. Of those 585 cases that were labeled as being unexplained, the statistics about the people who reported them is even more staggering. Firstly, there was an astronomer who stated there was no such thing as UFOs because he hadn't heard of any sightings being reported by astronomers. Well, sorry, pal, check the Blue Book files, and you'll find that there have been several sightings reported by reputable astronomers. In addition to this, we have almost more than a dozen commercial pilots and almost 100 military or ex-military pilots who have reported a UFO sighting. In those same 585 unexplained sightings, we have more than 200 sightings by military people of all ranks, from enlisted men to colonels being reported, including a former OSI agent and top secret control officer. Some of the other witnesses who have come with some pretty credible credentials for being able to identify what they see in the sky are over 100 people who were directly involved with the aviation industry, including somebody who is a professional aircraft illustrator. Needless to say, somebody like that probably knows what a plane or a jet looks like when it is in the air. And finally, and I'm sure that this will make Stanton Friedman's day, because he's been theorizing that the atomic bomb detonations are why we're being visited, of the 585 unexplained Blue Book cases, more than 30 of the witnesses of those cases are associated with the Atomic Energy Commission. Now, these aren't numbers I'm making up. They're not numbers that I massaged to make a cute presentation. They are verified numbers by the United States Air Force. And these are the people who desperately do not want us to think there are UFOs out there because, bottom line, they're powerless to do a damn thing about them.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you. Talk to you later. Say hi to Stuart for me.
Why don't you say hi to Stuart for yourself?
Hello, Dave. And
that
was a fabulous take.
It was.
Thank you.
you always accuse me, Dave, of ruining it.
So. I never do now.
Good night, Dave.
Good night.
And joining us, as you hear on the line, is regular monthly correspondent, British correspondent, Stuart Miller is with us. Stuart publishes the UFO Review, the latest issue, the August-September, is available online. It's a free monthly zine published on the web, and each issue carries extensive interviews with those in the ufological field and associated subjects, as well as contributed articles, regular features, comment, cartoons, and usually a dose of satire or three thrown in somewhere as well. And you can get it as a PDF file or a Word file. Yeah, a bit of harking back to the death of Dr. John Mack, some news as a result of the trial of the man who was drunk driving when he hit Dr. Mack.
Yes, an interesting turn of events during the course of today, because the sentence was announced yesterday, and for those that haven't heard it, Raymond Tchaikovsky, who was the accused, was sentenced to 15 months in prison and disqualified from driving for 3 years. He has to take an extended test. I don't know if you have those in Canada, but it's about double the length of the normal driving test in order to get his license back.
Mm-hmm.
The sentence came as a shock, 15 months.
Yes.
A shock on the basis, you know, it was negligible, it was minimal.
It was like a slap on the wrist, and
exactly.
there was some quite indignant reaction from various subscribers to the UFO Updates email list.
Yes, perfectly understandably as well. And I felt embarrassed because I thought, oh, it's British justice cocking up again, pardon the expression. But and then we had this quite remarkable statement that you published on the updates list from the John Mack Institute, where it was revealed that the family had specifically written to the judge concerned prior to sentencing asking for leniency. And even quite incredibly included the statement that they would have preferred if Mrs. Tchaikovsky hadn't actually gone to prison at all. I can understand where they're coming from with that, but I think that it's a restricted point of view. When you kill somebody behind the wheel of a car as a result of being drunk, there has to be a custodial sentence. There is no question about that. Otherwise, you are just sending out the wrong signals.
Judge Linda Stern told Tchaikovsky that she had considered the most generous letter written by the family of Professor Mack, but noted that a message must be sent that you shouldn't drive with alcohol in your blood.
One could argue that, in fact, she listened to the contents or took into account the contents of that letter perhaps a little too much. I mean, in the end, he's going to serve, as it says, probably about 6 months, taking into account time already spent in custody. 6 months for killing a human being.
It seems to me that Dr. Mack's family's plea for leniency, it reflects John Mack for the people that knew him, you know, because he was a very gentle man and had a sort of very Buddhist take on life, so compassion and forgiveness.
Well, indeed, as I said at the beginning, I can understand where they're coming from, but you can't get away with taking a life like that.
Well, he's going to have to carry it around with him for the rest of his life, so, you know, that'll be on his conscience.
Well, I hope it stays on his conscience.
Yeah, I hope so too. We lost a fine man when we lost Dr. John Mack.
At least, at last, it's brought that situation to a conclusion, because it has been dragging on for far too long.
Yeah. So, what else?
Well, slightly more positive, although you'll excuse me if I... No enthusiasm seems to sort of creep into my voice because I really should be bouncing up and down. Next week, aliens are going to be crawling all over British TV.
They've been doing it for the last 2 or 3 weeks all over North American TV.
Oh, would that be on the History Channel?
No, everywhere. Invasion, the 4400 is playing up here in Canada.
Oh, no, I meant documentary series. I sit here in eager anticipation, having read all about the new fall season in the States, well, and in North America, with all the alien and paranormal programs that have started. I'm just wondering, you know, how long it's going to take for them to filter over here. Oh, no, we've got a proper pucker, two-hour documentary at prime evening time, 9 till 11, well, 10 past 11, on Thursday of this week, at Channel 4, and what's it all about? Well, it's with aviation journalist Nick Cook, who is the editor of Jane's Defense Weekly,
right,
and also the author of The Hunt for Zero Point. And do you remember, you probably have forgotten, but in closing, last time I was on, I was telling you about some Mickey Mouse papier-mâché exhibition at the Science Museum.
Right, I remember. How could I forget?
And it's to tie in with that. But, very interesting, long interviews filmed with ufologists both in the States and here, in the UK, Nick Redfern and various other UFO experts.
All named Nick, yeah.
And believe it or not, Dave Clark and Andy Roberts. We're interviewed over here in a secret Cold War bunker somewhere in darkest Essex.
Ooh, I bet that added an atmosphere too, huh?
Well, I hope that the producers lock them in afterwards and left them there.
I can't believe you said that live on radio, Stuart Miller.
Oh, I'm very good friends with Andy. Oh, indeed.
Yes, I bet you are. Like me too, probably, huh?
Well, I was, actually, until I said that. Actually, it looks like a serious attempt. In fact, I have seen Nick Cook's work in relation to UFOs on TV before. He did one a few years ago. I think he was trying to prove that they were real. Hmm. But listen to this. He has unearthed extraordinary new evidence, blah, 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 which shows that key people at the heart of the military-industrial complex have taken the UFO threat sufficiently seriously to devote millions of pounds to investigating it.
Yeah.
Well, he doesn't take part in tabloid journalism. I will say that.
Yes.
He is a serious journalist. So
he writes for a well-known publisher of... serious magazines on various aspects of military technology, yes.
Actually, I do vaguely remember that the last documentary he did on UFOs, which, as I say, was about a few years ago. But I remember his approach, which basically was to tap people that he knew in black projects in the States as a result of his contacts in journalism, to tap them on the shoulder and say, tell me, are UFOs real? I mean, yeah, and these guys are going to turn around and say, yeah, of course they are. No, well, they didn't, needless to say.
Seems to me he popped up in a documentary about Area 51 a few years ago, too.
He may have done. I spent all day in Blackpool, which is about 70 miles away from me, at a conference today.
Oh, and you and Jack and Vera Duckworth.
Yeah, but I didn't see them. But I hate to tell you, but my experience at this conference sounds a little like the way you were telling me you are at UFO conferences. Not very focused.
I find it really difficult to stay awake at UFO conferences. 5 minutes into the start of the damn things and I'm falling asleep.
I must say straight away, before I rip the whole thing apart, that I actually enjoyed it. And I think the audience did as well. And in fact, I'm sure they did. And I will say this, they had a very good turnout. I think there must have been at least 200 people there, which, right, doesn't sound astronomical, but that's a pretty good turnout for a conference. Needless to say, I didn't get there on time. I walked in on a guy called Mike Oram, who was talking about his experiences that he shared with Fran in Area 51.
With Fran?
Yeah, I've no idea who Fran is.
Probably his companion.
Well, it could have been pet dog or his spider.
Pet,
you know.
Pet sheep?
That was normally the title of the piece, but I didn't hear any references to Area 51 at all.
Oh, my.
I did hear a lot of talk about chakras and light beings and global consciousness and light beaming, missing, blah, blah. You know, you get the general picture.
Yes, well-meaning people.
Yes. This is very interesting. I wandered around the hall where there were a few stalls placed hither and thither. And it's a two-day conference, this, although I'm not going tomorrow. And One of the speakers from who's going to speak tomorrow on Sunday, a gentleman by the name of Gary Rowe, had displayed, now this is really quite unique, so I'm wondering why it was so low-key, had displayed on one of the stalls that was up against the back walls, he had some genuine UFO debris from a crash in 1983 in North Wales, and apparently he's got hold of this debris because he got to the crash site before the MOD did.
Oh, really?
Yep. And he's got the sample, the certificate of authenticity, and 9 pages of information on it, and a copy of the newspaper report, and it costs £10.
There must be rather a lot of it.
Well, it's, and obviously genuine.
The conference in Blackpool. Are there other things that you want to get into in the remaining moments?
Yes, actually. Go ahead.
I've
got what you might call a pub quiz question for you, and it's prompted, actually, by an article in this week's Daily Telegraph, London Daily Telegraph, which you actually put up on updates, prompted by the fact that a Professor Paul Davis, he's a British cosmologist, but he works at the Australian Centre for Astrobiology at Macquarie University, and he's come back home, so obviously some journo has got hold of him. He chaired the International Academy of Aeronautics Post-Detection Committee, along with Astronomer Royal Sir Martin Rees, and I think they're tasked with trying to work out what to do with ET when they make contact with him. But what's really interesting is his concluding comments at the very end of the rather long and lengthy interview about SETI, which is that it's a glorious but almost certainly hopeless quest.
Yes.
But of course, in true logic, that does not mean it is a waste of time.
Nor the millions and millions of dollars that are being poured into it.
Well, it has many important spin-offs.
Oh, it does.
But don't ask me what they are.
Ah.
But in the course of any article on SETI, inevitably there is a reference to Jill Tarter and...
Jodie Foster.
yes.
Sorry.
Jacques Vallée has been in the news again this week with us, and of course I connect him with Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Mm-hmm.
So really, the question I was going to ask you was, that's two people from real life who have been represented in alien stroke ET movies. And I don't have the answer to the question I'm about to ask you, but can you think of any more?
Oh my. No.
Well, perhaps you'd like to throw that question out to your listeners.
Which real-life people have been featured in movies about UFOs or aliens or space? And James Tiberius Kirk doesn't count.
Okay, well, University of Glamorgan started what was known as an astrobiological degree course this week, but of course the press got hold of it, twisted it, and said, go to university and learn to look for ET.
Yes, and the man who put out the press release on that on the blog there at the University of Glamorgan was quite amazed that there was so much reaction out there around the planet.
Yes.
Well, duh.
It's a shame we haven't got time for that poem.
Stuart, thank you, sir. We'll leave it at that. Stuart Miller, publisher of UFO Review at uforeview.net. Thank you, Stuart. Good night.
All the best.
Patrick Cook is the author of The Greatest Deception, The Bible, UFO Connection. Quoting from his website, Patrick was raised in the Baptist Church and groomed to be a minister from the age of 9. He left the church by age 17 over doctrinal disputes. He attended Texas Christian University, various theological courses with emphasis on comparative theology. He received an AA, but no graduate degrees. He's an autonomous theologian, not influenced or connected to a specific religiously structured belief. He's also an eschatologist. Eschatology, the branch of theology concerned with final things such as death and judgment, heaven and hell, the end of the world. He's been an independent researcher for 35 years and is a respecter of all beliefs and individual freedom of thought and expression. His work at his BibleUFO.com website does not attempt to prove God is an alien. It presents ample evidence and simple logic that the gods have been mistaken for an alien race. Joining us on the phone from his home down there on the West Coast in California is Patrick Cook. Patrick, good evening and welcome to Strange Days Indeed.
Good evening to you, Errol.
It's good to have you on the program. We've talked many times in the past about Bible references to what we think are UFOs and the gods, and it's good to have somebody who has spent a fair amount of time looking into this. As a kid, you were being groomed to be a minister from the age of 9. What caused you to leave by the age of 17?
Well, basically, I challenged the canons of the church. In the American Baptist Convention, where I was raised, there are 13 basic canons, and I challenged those scripturally, and that caused my dismissal. Basically, the church does not wish to be questioned. Most of the beliefs within the church are basically from the church fathers, their interpretation of what they believe the Bible is saying. And I'm a strict scriptural theologian. I go by what it says, try to eliminate the metaphor as much as possible. And one of the most important things to consider is in this work, the Bible UFO Connection, we deal strictly with the King James Bible, the Bible that's accepted by the Protestant Church. And 66 books of that Bible were translated in 1611 AD into a rather obscure language used by the English court and very limited in its structure because it only contains about 8,000 words, individual words. The Bible is interpreted from Hebrew and Chaldee in the Old Testament and Greek and Aramaic in the New Testament. And there are about, I'm not sure the exact number of words, but probably about 10 times the amount of words all told in those languages. And then they had to cram them down into individual words in that obscure language. So what we do is we use one reference source for all interpretation that we make on this website, and that's Strong's Exhaustive Concordance, which was a 35-year project back in the late 1800s by James Strong with 100 of the top linguists and historians of the day, and they trace back the original meanings of every word in the Bible and catalog it in what is known as Strong's Exhaustive Concordance. And we use that exclusively. It's available online so anybody can check our translations. One of the most important things that I originally discovered was the actual meaning of the word heaven. Heaven is in the Bible in the Old and New Testament in 700 verses. And 99.7% of the time, in all but actually two instances, the word heaven refers to the sky or things related to the sky. It does not mean an ethereal place or a divine retirement home. So when you see things happening in the Bible and they're happening in heaven, it actually means they're happening in the sky. And if you read it in context and literally as it's written, you'll find that that's easily understandable. Basically, what I believe is that if you simply read the Bible and you take the word heaven and change it into sky every time you run into that word, you're going to have a better understanding of what's actually going on. And what we present is the concept that God uses a flying saucer. Now, if you go to my website, BibleUFO.com, right at the top of the page, there's a link to flying vehicles and advanced technology in the Bible. If you click on that link, it will take you to a main page where we categorize this concept into five basic categories. The most important one that we deal with is the vehicles themselves. Now, we have 362 verses on this website describing what we believe are flying vehicles described in the context of an ancient civilization upwards of 6,000 years old where they didn't have anything flying in the sky, lights weren't artificial, it was fire, it was clouds. Mm-hmm. If anything was spinning in the sky, it was a whirlwind.
Struggling to describe a technology that they didn't understand, presumably.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. But they talked about it considerably. The most common question that we get is considering the omnipotence of God as portrayed by the church, then it seems rather ridiculous that God would need a flying vehicle to travel around. But if you'll look in Exodus 19:9, there's a very fascinating verse there. It reads, "And the Lord said to Moses, Lo, I come to thee in a thick cloud, that the people may hear thee, they hear when I speak with thee, and believe thee forever. And Moses told the words of the people unto the Lord." So basically what he's saying is that he does come to him in a thick cloud. Now, the word cloud generally comes from a word which means a thundercloud or a dark scud cloud, which are the low clouds you see below the higher clouds. They're called scud clouds, a very dark cloud. So they seem to, he's talking about something thick and dark. Now, if you look at the original way that this was written, and you can find this in Strong's Exhaust Concordance, the words unto thee in the phrase come unto thee, with thee in the phrase speak with thee, and thee in the in believe thee were all added by the translators. So if you take those words out, this is the way this verse reads. And the Lord said unto Moses, lo, I come in a thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak and believe forever. Now that in itself is a very definitive statement that for some reason this God, Jehovah, he is the creator of the planet and the God that you generally see dealing with individuals such as Moses, Abraham. He's the God, the national God of Israel, and he's the one that's speaking to this. Now, you go from that point and you start looking up what it says about the clouds in the Bible. Now, in that particular category under clouds, we have 70 verses that describe things. The first one where clouds are mentioned as a possible vehicle, it says that it came to pass as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the children of Israel that they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. Generally, when you see the Lord, Jehovah, when you see him interacting with people, there's a cloud or a pillar or a whirlwind or a throne or something in his presence. From that point, we've got the categories are divided into thrones, chariots, dwellings, lights and fire associated with these vehicles, objects that spin, dark objects, and a variety of other vehicles that are described.
There are several helpful hints there on how to read the Bible. Patrick Cook is our guest. The Lord Yahweh, or Jehovah of the Old Testament, who became the Lord Jesus of the New Testament, is described as flying in the Bible, flying in thick clouds, swift clouds, bright clouds, dark clouds, white clouds, low clouds, great clouds, and fiery clouds. There are platforms, vessels, whirling chariots of fire, sky thrones, fiery horses, cherubims, thick darkness, great fire, whirlwinds, fiery wheels, pavilions, dark waters, storms, sky dwellings, rolls, and sanctuaries. How else would a primitive people describe what it is that they're seeing flying through the sky, except in those words? A lot of people are suggesting that the Bible is not so much a religious book, more a history book.
Well, we don't believe it's religious in the sense of church mm-hmm. and the environment that church portrays, the ambiance of the church, the humble, quiet, mystical, ethereal. The attitude in the church somewhat represents the level of approach that they give to the doctrines that they present. They simply don't talk about this. If you take the number of verses we have just described vehicles and the flight characteristics of these vehicles, we have got about 1.5% of all of the entire content of the Bible. And that's a lot to be completely ignored. The way that these things fly, the appearance that they have. Let me read a verse real quick. This is one that most people will remember about when Elijah was taken up in a whirlwind. Mm-hmm. It says, and it came to pass, as they still went on and talked, and behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire, and parted them asunder, and Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. Now we see in Psalms 104:3, it says, who layeth the beams of his chambers in the water? Who maketh the clouds his chariot? Who walk upon the wings of the wind. Now, the other verse that's very important to consider in this concept, in Psalm 68:17, this is stated, the chariots of God are 20,000, even thousands of angels. The Lord is among them, as in the Sinai, in the holy place. The phrase 20,000 was translated from the word ribo, which means an indefinitely large number. It does not mean 20,000. It means an infinite number. The phrase the Lord of hosts is used considerably throughout the Bible. And the word host comes from a word which means armies. And the Lord of Hosts is described, and the host is described as doing various things. What we believe is very clearly defined in the work is that what we may be speaking of here is a fleet of these vehicles. With the descriptions, they are rapidly flying, glowing, spinning objects that ascend, descend, and hover for long periods of time. In the case of the Old Testament, where they were hovering over the Exodus out of Egypt, they would hover over them for months. In that section particularly, a lot of people think of a pillar because the description is always of a pillar of fire. The word is kaub that word is translated from, and it has a dual meaning. It can either mean a column or it can mean the base of that column. Therefore, what we may be speaking of is a platform rather than a pillar of fire. It says it was like a dark cloud during the day, and at night it could literally be translated into a platform of fire.
Maybe a light beam, too, because we've had a lot of modern-day reports of light beams from these objects in the sky. The implication is UFOs have been around since time immemorial. The cave paintings in Australia and in Europe and, in fact, all over the globe, dating back tens of thousands of years, suggest beings in spacesuits or beings with very large eyes floating through the air. And here, according to Patrick Cook in the Bible, there are all kinds of indicators if you know how the words were mistranslated in the official King James version of the Bible. What did you say it was for ancient languages, Patrick?
It's Hebrew and Chaldee in the Old Testament and Greek and Aramaic in the New Testament.
And now, the miracles that happened, and you mentioned the exodus from Egypt of the Israelites, Moses led them across, well, the parted waters. Now, you know, what kind of magic is that an old man like Moses could do? Or was it him that did it?
Arthur C. Clarke made a very interesting statement that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Yes.
Now, if you're looking at the Bible in an ethereal sense, a metaphorical sense, and you're not considering that these are real things that are happening to very real people in a very real world, it's very hard to grasp the concepts that what we may be seeing in a lot of cases within the Bible is a level of high technology. One of the interesting aspects is sound that is emanating from these vehicles. Now, in Deuteronomy 4:12, there's a very interesting statement. It says, "And the Lord spake unto you out of the midst of the fire." Now, we believe this fire they're speaking of was possibly a craft on the ground glowing. "You heard the voice of the words, but saw no similitude. Only you heard a voice." Similitude means a visible likeness or an embodiment of something. Clearly, they are as amazed by hearing a being speak remotely as probably the first telephone caller or radio listener were. They were fascinated. He emphasizes that they were hearing sound out of this fire, but you couldn't see who was speaking. That sounds like broadcasting to me.
Or a PA system, or it's like the voice of God issuing forth from the Ark of the Covenant.
Right. And then you hear there were thunders and lightnings, and you hear about trumpet sounds coming from these vehicles.
Which is what the mothership made in Close Encounters, if you recall.
Right. Oh, then that's an absolutely fascinating aspect of that. Now, this is strictly a personal opinion, but I've always been of the opinion that music itself may have originated with these vehicles. Because according to what we know, the first reference to a vehicle is actually in Genesis. So it's very early that we begin to see these craft operating. We have over 2,000 sightings throughout history. It's absolutely amazing. Many of them describing exactly the same things that you hear in the patriarchs, the prophets, the people that are seeing these things. And then you read through history and you see people describing them almost exactly the same way. They have been with us all this time. I'm sure you're familiar with Vimanas.
Of course, yes. The flying machines in the Vedic scriptures.
If you look at it comprehensively and in the big picture, many, many of the major gods are specifically spoken of as flying, and their vehicles are actually described. So the flying God concept is not just a biblical concept. The flying God appears throughout ancient history. It's in all the ancient writings. There are many similarities. Studying comparative theology, you're eventually going to start seeing a lot of similarities in the world's religions. There may be a possibility here that we are not speaking of many gods throughout the world. What we may be seeing is many cultures speaking of the same God, but putting it in a completely different sense according to their culture, the place they live, the way they think, the customs of their society. We may be talking about the same God. Indigenous populations in North America have many gods that are from virgin births. They are saviors. They are going away, and then they're going to come back. The second coming is very common throughout the religions of the world. And one of the important things to the Christian community is the fact that the Bible clearly speaks of Jesus coming in the clouds at the second coming. Imagine that these clouds have more of a physical characteristics, and imagine if they are UFOs. And a whole fleet of UFOs comes into our atmosphere suddenly. It's going to have an incredible impact, and we don't know how the world is actually going to react to it.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, Patrick, because according to Stuart Miller, who was on a little while ago, and one or two other people I've spoken to recently, there is definite movement underway to address that very topic by a lot of influential people around the planet. How do we handle the possibility or the eventuality of them coming down and saying, well, guys, here we are?
Well, let's fast forward from the second coming to the battle at Armageddon. According to prophecy, nobody's going to be convinced. There is going to be the largest army ever gathered together is going to be gathered together, according to prophecy, according to the book of Revelations, gathered together in that valley to fight against the returning Christ, quite literally. If you take that concept to its ultimate, you can imagine that there are going to be soldiers in that battle that are going to be praying for help from the same God they are fighting. An amazing concept. But the reason that I call it the greatest deception is that in Matthew 24:30 it says, and then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, which is the sky, and then shall the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Now, if these clouds are more than just fluffy, white, misty things up in the sky, this could be very serious, but backtrack when you see, and then shall the tribes of the earth mourn. This is the second coming of Christ. They are not rolling out the red carpet.
No, and they won't be playing Happy Days Here Again either.
If you consider the fact that we are the only work that I know of on the internet that are presenting this concept, if we are correct, then what you're basically going to see is that people are going to be confused by what's going on, and the only source that they're going to have is a source like ours. But we honestly don't believe we're going to change anything. We only are here to inform people about the reality. There is no movement, no church associated with this work.
Yes.
This is for informational purposes only.
It's amazing how cult-like the churches are today. Ask no questions and just sit there and behave yourself and do as we say, and on occasion, do as we do. Patrick Cook is with us, the author of The Greatest Deception, The Bible UFO Connection. That's also his website, The Bible UFO Connection, and that's BibleUFO.com. There is just so much information at Patrick Cook's website that it's just impossible to cover it all in 7 or 8 hours on the radio, let alone a single hour. Mike up there in Brampton joins us. Mike, good evening. Welcome to Strange Days Indeed, and say hi to Patrick.
Good evening, and thanks for having me, and hi, Patrick.
Hi, Mike.
You know, it's obviously not too hard to imagine that people back in Bible times would see these kind of strange occurrences as religious phenomenon. But you said that the Bible was edited around the 6th century A.D., was it?
The King James Bible that we have now was published in 1611 A.D.
Oh, right, okay.
It was actually published with the complete Apocrypha, the 15 books of the Apocrypha, but that was removed in 1885.
Right.
In the 4th century, the Emperor Constantine had a very heavy influence, basically removed all sense of what the original Church of the Bible had created.
Right, and that's what I was going to ask, is have you had an opportunity to ever study any material about anything that was omitted in that early edition of the Bible? Is there anything that covers more of the subject that you are looking at, or anything else? Missing or omitted Gospels from the Bible, is there such a thing?
On our website, we have a section called The Lost Books of the Bible. We have over 700 books listed there. About 85% of them are online and can be read.
Mm-hmm.
There are 22 books that are mentioned in the Bible that are not included. As for the original text that we've got, we believe it's fairly accurate. The Old Testament was first put together by Eusebius, who was a friend,
right,
a consort, as it were, of the Emperor Constantine. And that Bible was actually just republished, or somebody, I believe Gutenberg put it online or something, but it's available to buy or view now. The authorized King James Version contains 66 books. We know the Apocrypha was in there. We know 11 of the books were referred to or quoted from in that book. We have found 4 of those 22. Enoch and Jasher are the two most important that we've been able to find. And I actually have the entire book of Enoch published on my website.
Oh, okay.
So for reading, I only have 2 books, the book of Enoch and the book of Barnabas, on my site, particularly those two. But Jasher is a very interesting, fascinating book. With these books, we present their history, and we allow the reader to decide whether they are inspired or not. If you're going to accept the Christian concept, you have to accept the 66 books that are in the Bible now and the 15 books of the Apocrypha that were omitted.
Yeah, there's a lot of material there to cover.
There certainly is, and I want to thank you for your call, sir.
All right, well worth it. Thanks.
Good night.
Bye.
Patrick, I want to thank you very much for being with us tonight. Perhaps in a month or two we could have you back and talk some more, because there's many, many, many hours of discussion here and the directions that we could go in. And I know there are a lot of people out there who are anxious to talk to you and haven't been able to make it through. To them,
well,
I apologize.
They can email me from the website.
Good night, Patrick. Rest well,
much.
Sir, and thank
okay.
you. Good night.
Okay.
That wraps it up for us. Eyes to the Skies, thanks for being with us. Thank you for your interest. Please do something with it. Tell people about it. Tell your politician. Good night.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp.